The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on the podcast this week, we're speaking with the living, breathing people behind Digital Death Day, a global event that reminds people that just because your Facebook account is immortal, you're not. Charles Arthur joins me in the studio to talk through the woeful quarterly results of RIM and how you can protect yourself from a phone-based virus that threatens to wipe everything off your mobile, but from far away. Also, the Information Commissioner's Office has new powers to find phone spammers, and The Well, one of the original online communities, is bought from Salon.com, saving it from the brink. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First up, Charles, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much. You just came back from Korea, did you not?
It's true, I did.
And what were you doing there?
I was there as a guest of Samsung. Yeah, South Korea, yes. The North Korean, I might not be back yet. But Samsung took me out there to see their new NAND flash facility that they have in Suwon, which makes the sort of NAND flash chips that you see in flash drives. And they're going to be having a big push next year, trying to persuade people to replace their spinning hard drives, HDDs, with solid-state storage, SSD.
And this is actually something that people like Apple have already been moving towards, haven't they, with their Airs and other devices?
Yeah, it's a trend that actually a lot of people at the sort of, you might call it the sort of the front edge of technology, have been doing. So actually inside Microsoft, a lot of the people who do coding, especially the people who are doing builds of Windows, they've had SSDs for years because it's so much faster. If you're doing things which involve a lot of reading of files, then they're easily 20 times faster than a spinning drive. And you have the advantage that if you've got it in a laptop, there's no moving parts. So if you pick it up suddenly, there's no chance of a disk head crash. And generally, they use less power. They're quieter.
But if you have a laptop, don't you need to remember to take something else with you if you've got external memory?
It's not external memory. It's built in.
You
actually build it in.
So I see.
You know, you can replace, if you just do a clone of your hard drive onto a new flash drive, you can then install the flash drive. It's not too hard in most laptops. And bam, you've got a completely new, much faster computer than you had before.
Wow. And you were saying something quite extraordinary about the factory.
They've got this incredible factory, which is the size of multiple football fields. It's either three or four, depending how you want to calculate it. And it's almost entirely automated. So there's really no humans involved except to fix things when stuff goes wrong. And when a piece of silicon starts at one end, it goes through various processes where it's etched, it gets sort of, a bit of acid bath to take stuff off, it gets more etching, da, 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 and it takes 4 weeks to go from going in to exiting. And when it exits, it then goes on to another factory, which then actually packages it up into drives.
That is absolutely unbelievable when you think about how instantly we expect things. I forget that the process behind creating a system that instantly connects me to the internet, that instantly allows me to, make a phone call or whatever, actually takes a heck of a lot of time to be physically made.
It's weird, but then again, farmers wait quite a long time for their stuff to go.
Yeah, thank you, farmers. Thank you very much, farmers. Speaking of Samsung, you wrote a story this week on The Guardian about Samsung and HTC, another mobile handset manufacturer, about how those handsets are actually vulnerable to attack from a virus, from a link. What's the story here?
It's a weakness in certain versions of the Android dialer software. So these are Android handsets. And what happens is that there is a link you can put onto websites which has the prefix, rather than HTTP, which is the hypertext transfer protocol, you have TEL, which is meant to be a telephone number. So normally you would put TEL :// and then you'd have a phone number which would then be passed when you clicked on it in a smartphone, would be passed to the dialer software, which would then start dialing that number. And it would be a way for doing automatic support. You know, if you want to find out if you've got this in stock, call this number.
So this, but this goes beyond, say, you know, the software recognizing that something is a phone number and asking if you want to call. This is just an automated dial instantly.
Well, it's more that the way that the dialer software is written in some phones, in some phone models, with some versions of the Android dialer software, the earlier versions, before 4.1, they will automatically implement what's in the link. So they'll start dialing the number. But you don't necessarily have a phone number in that string. You can have lots of other things. So you can have codes. So, for example, most people will be familiar with, if you go to your phone and on your mobile phone and you do *#06#, you will get what's called the IMEI number of your phone, which is, you know, a unique code that identifies your phone. It's sort of like the serial number. But these go beyond that. And for the Samsung ones especially, there's a factory reset code. So if you enter this number in, or the string in, which it's a sort of string of hashes and stars and so on, then it will factory reset your phone.
So it's actually not a virus. It's just perhaps somebody being quite cheeky on their website.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't call it a virus in as much as it's not self-replicating. It can't pass on from one phone to another. It's more in the way of a Trojan horse, sort of, because it fools people in what it actually is.
It's an unpleasant prank.
Yes. But you could, for example, make it look like a link to Google. You know, you could dress it up as, you know, here you are, click this and do a Google search.
And why
and in
would
fact,
you
underneath
do?
It'd be a tell link.
Yeah, why would you do that?
Because you're malicious.
Because you're a nasty piece of work, basically.
But, you know, there are people out there who are like that. And, you know, there certainly do seem to be some examples out there where people have experimented it. With HTC is saying that they don't have a factory reset code. They're saying we're not vulnerable to this. But there do seem to be lots of other codes out there which do all sorts of things. They can wipe SIMs. They can disable SIMs. They can activate the PIN unlock or the PIN lock code on your SIM. So, you know, while HTC is saying we're not vulnerable to the factory reset thing here, there does seem to be questions still about what vulnerabilities do exist. As I say, the key weakness is that it's in the Android dialer software, and this exists in lots and lots of phones, millions literally of phones.
Is this something that can be updated?
The way to beat it is to download an alternative dialer program from the Android market, or Google Play as it is now, and you'll then get the option of which one you want to open a string with before you actually start dialing it.
No,
bit of an inconvenience.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you'd rather just get along and, you know, get on and do it. And the alternative is that Samsung or the phone company start pushing out the patch. And Samsung says it has pushed out a patch, but not everyone has received it. So it's really down to the phone companies to start pushing that out.
Well, also this week in phone news, the Information Commissioner's Office announced that they were fining some phone spammers to quite an impressive degree. Charles, what happened this week?
The ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, which I have to say usually is not thought of as wielding a very big stick. Usually it's sort of a lot of talk, but not very much in the way of action. They have recently been given powers, which mean they can fine people up to £500,000 for breaches of the Data Protection Act. And what they have said is that they will fine two people around about £250,000 each individually for a number of breaches of the Data Protection Act, where people have received phone spams relating to, have you had an accident, you may be able to get repayments, or PPI claims, payment protection insurance, you know, you could be eligible for a big payout. And they said that among the other things that these people did was that if you were to, they didn't say where they were from, which is a breach of the law. People hadn't opted in to receiving them, which again is another breach. And when people did text back saying stop, as it said on the text, when people did that, the numbers would simply be added to another list and then sold on to other people who
exactly.
would continue spamming.
And a live telephone. Mm. These phones are actual telephones.
Indeed.
List. When I was visiting my mother in India a couple of years ago, she had a mobile phone. And this mobile phone was literally inundated. And I couldn't, you know, it was impossible to use when I was borrowing it from her, because it was probably maybe every hour, maybe hour and a half, there would be another message exactly like the one that you're describing. She would have never opted into it, and it just was absolutely rife. They just came, they were just pushed to her phone. So why is it that it's allowable in, you know, in places like India? I know that in the US people get, you know, phone calls all the time. What's the story here? How is the ICO, you know, what's our data protection laws here that's different from those places?
The key difference is that the EU has a data protection framework, and that was started to be put in place in the 1980s and has been strengthened considerably since then, so that now it covers your mobile phone number, it covers your home address, it covers your email address, and companies which are based in the EU cannot market to you without your consent. You have to have an existing relationship with them before they can contact you in this sort of way. So the ICO is finally starting to find its feet and is starting to, you know, punch its weight, I think you would say, because, you know, a lot of people have been very annoyed by these things. And the ICO says that it's going after these two people, but there are another eight companies that it's pursuing in the same way. It hasn't named these two people because it's given them 28 days to explain in what way what they were doing could possibly be legal. So in that sense, they have some recourse. If they don't come up with a sufficient answer, then it can fine them the £250,000 or so. They could possibly choose to take that to the courts and appeal that through the courts. But I think that they would find it could be difficult to argue against the ICO, because the ICO obviously has to make sure it has a watertight case before it acts in this way.
Why is the ICO taking this move now? Why is it suddenly stepped up, manned up, as it were?
Partly because it's now able to exact these sorts of fines, and it thinks that exacting these fines will act as a deterrent against people. You know, the thought of being fined £750,000 tends to focus the mind a bit, you know, rather like being hanged in the morning. So I think that that's the key reason. And they've been looking at, well, what are the things that really annoyed people? And it is things like, have you had an accident you might be able to claim, and PPI claims, you know, both of which actually you could really follow through for yourself, especially PPI, where you can make your own claims without having to go through a claims company, and you'd be better off.
Also this week, RIM, the beleaguered telephone, well, they make the BlackBerry handset and do the BlackBerry operating system, has announced its latest figures. Charles, I feel like we need to sort of throw some white lilies around the table and, you know, play the...
It's a bit like the funeral march.
It is. We need the funeral march in here.
But, okay, so the numbers are that it made its third quarterly loss. It beat analyst expectations by having revenues of $2.9 billion. It shipped 7.4 million handsets, which is its lowest figure since the end of 2009. It shipped 130,000 playbooks in the entire quarter. And for comparison, Apple shipped 17 million iPads in the previous quarter, which is about the same number in a day.
Do you think maybe that was just for novelty's sake? People were saying, quick, get in.
Well, yeah, it is a bit like that.
Oh,
and,
dear.
The losses were $235 million. So you've got to say it's not going well. And yet,
Charles, that's good analysis.
And yet, they managed to increase their cash position. They say that they have more cash now than they did one quarter ago. And this seems to have been done by squeezing their accounts receivable. So, you know, people who owe the money, they've been getting heavy on them, reducing the inventory so that there's less money tied up in stuff sitting around in warehouses, and also in some write-offs, which I've got to say doesn't, you know, perhaps it's because I'm not an accountant, doesn't seem to me like real cash that you can actually spend, but there it is. You know, they're able to say that their cash position has improved.
Have they sold anybody? Have they ever owned other companies, other patents?
The only thing that they were looking to sell was a jet plane. They have two jets. They have two private jets. And I've been trying to find out more about them because they're...
Because you want it. yeah, you know, you could probably get a really good bargain, Charles.
I probably could, couldn't I? They own a company called Waterloo Aviation, about which I've been trying to find more, which owns two jets. It's got a 9-seater from memory and a 13-seater. I think they're looking to sell... I think it's a 13-seater they're looking to sell, which they used to fly clients and people around with. And they've decided that that's a bit sort of superfluous to business at the moment. They could get a few million dollars for it. Why not sell it off? No news on whether they managed to sell that. But if anyone out there has news about Waterloo Aviation, please do tell me.
Indeed, yes. You can get in touch with Charles at charles.arthur@guardian.co.uk. Or if you want to send us a generic email, you can send it to techweekly@guardian.co.uk. Finally in the news this week, The Well, one of the original online communities, was saved from the apparent brink from being shut down by Salon.com, who had bought The Well earlier in, this decade, but it was bought by a consortium of The Well's original members. Charles, can you tell me a little bit more about The Well?
So The Well started in the 1980s, and it was a sort of bulletin board, except it was in San Francisco. It was all the great and the good of the online fraternity in San Francisco. So it has that sort of pedigree, I guess you would say, where being a member was being a member of a sort of exclusive club. And it was sort of looked on as a landmark on the web.
It was originally called the Whole Earth Electronic Link, which is where the Well moniker comes from, isn't it?
Yeah, much easier to say Well.
Yeah, it certainly is. Electronic is. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as a benchmark in the history of the web, it's pretty important, isn't it? Because as you say, it was, you know, one of the first communities, and it had the great and the good of the internet. So, you know, it's a good thing that it's being saved, isn't it?
Well, it's not a bad thing, certainly. I mean, you could sort of, you know, query, does it make a great difference to our lives, whether it's there or not? You know, for most people, I don't think they'd come across The Well at any point. And its sort of principal value, as I say, is more as a sort of nexus for all the greats and the goods, the sort of Harold Reingolds and, you know, Doc Searleses and so on of this
world. John Perry Barlow, I believe.
Indeed.
Stuart Brand as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So really the kind of the forefathers of what we would consider now to be how it is that we communicate online. Yeah, I mean, so it is. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's nice to that it existed. So should it still exist? Obviously, because the members themselves bought it, it's not hurting anybody. It's over there in the corner doing its you know its thing.
It's
but it
stuff.
Continues. Yeah, it continues to do its welly thing. But this kind of raises questions to me about what is it that we should save? This is a piece of internet history, and there are going to be more and more of these old guard legacy assets to the web that are going to become less and less relevant as people move forward, as they progress in, inevitably towards, you know, an era even beyond Facebook.
I mean, it's interesting to contrast The Well with GeoCities, for example. GeoCities, which was the big go and publish your own website, you know, make your sort of frontier post on the web sort of thing in the 1990s, which was then bought by Yahoo and then shut down by Yahoo. Now, you could argue that actually GeoCities is far more important than The Well, that, you know, everything that went on there is really much more representative of the early life of the web than all the stuff that goes on The Well, you know, highly rarefied that might be. Actually, that's much more representative. So why couldn't GeoCities be saved? Well, it's because there are far more people. Thing about The Well is there's not so many people, they're pretty affluent comparatively, so they could band together and you know, get the money together to buy themselves out. With GeoCities, you know, that would just be like herding fish. You just never get it to happen.
I can imagine a similar thing might happen in the future if people, you know, who at the moment I don't know are 15 and who are frequently interacting via Facebook would, you know, when they become in their late 50s, as many of the people who did band together to buy The Well are, turned around and went, you want to shut down Facebook? Can you imagine? I mean, can you imagine something like a group of people banding together to hold on to all of our status updates and our photos of our pets and our, you know, children?
It's intriguing, isn't it? Because actually it becomes easier to get concerted effort and to do these things when you have a small group than when you have a large group. I mean, yeah, that's absolutely typical that small groups are far easier to organise and to you know, find a common cause with. And I suspect that is what we're going to see, that without big amounts of charitable funding, in effect, you're not going to see efforts to save stuff like GeoCities, but you are going to see things like the well being saved because it's just much easier to do. I mean, in this, you've got to say that the Internet Archive is a fascinating exception, really.
And now this is the, I think it's the Wayback Machine. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Archive.org.
Which is an absolutely amazing project, actually. If you start to look back and you start to sort of, if you know what you're looking for, which is a big problem when it comes to the Wayback Machine, if you know what you're looking for, then you can see the BBC, the very first BBC website, or you can see, you know, the very first time that you posted something onto Flickr, or you can see, you know, you can see an incredible archive, a snapshot of a day, a time of the web. But as more and more people go online and as communities, you know, expand and explode into something like 900 million people, which is how many people are on Facebook now, is something like the Wayback Machine going to be able to cope? Are we going to be able to maintain that kind of archiving activity, or should we just let it all go in the digital ether?
I don't know. I think that's a question for them. But it gets much harder, clearly, because you know there's just so much more stuff to do. And I have to, you know, I found the Wayback Machine invaluable when I was, you know, writing my book, because I was able to look back at periods in 2001, 1995, and, you know, whatever sort of period, and be able to zero in on pages and how they had been, you know, where blogs had vanished, for example. And I knew that I'd read something at a time and I wanted to get back to it, and I could actually, you know, call it up out of the dark morass of the web.
Things never die online,
well,
people.
Well, you never think things never die, but actually they, you know, sometimes they do, and sometimes you can't get them back, and that's really frustrating. So it's almost as though you need interlinked efforts to curate and to archive the web. But I still think that the challenge of trying to, you know, keep all this stuff and believe that all the stuff will exist forever is, you know, that's a dangerous belief to have.
It's a Herculean effort.
Well, yeah, and the reality is still, you know, I'd still reiterate it that it's the small ones that are actually much easier to keep, because you can stick them on a server. You know, you can archive them. It's not that hard. And someone, if they've got a bit of money, can bring them back to life.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to bring back a gigantic social network.
Yeah, something like YouTube with, I mean, the gigabytes and gigabytes that are uploaded every day with the video. I mean, I'm still in a search for, if anybody can help me with this, I'm devastated that this video is no longer available. Mystic Cat. Kitty is a very bad mystic. Of course it's a cat video, but that's gone. It's gone, man. I can't find it anywhere. So if anybody can help, that would be fantastic. Speaking of what we should save, next up in Tech Weekly, we ask exactly that. What of our digital assets should we save in our own lives? And how should we prepare for the inevitable? Two people invested in this subject are Adriana Katsimatis and Victoria Moore. And they joined me in the Guardian studio earlier today to talk me through my digital legacy. So I'm joined now by Adriana Katsimatis and Victoria Moore. Adriana is the co-founder and co-developer, as it were, of the Digital Death Day event that's happening this weekend. Hello, Adriana.
Hello.
And Victoria Moore is the developer of the Legacy app. And hello, Victoria.
Hello, Alex.
Thank you both very much for joining me. First, Adriana, can you tell me a little bit about Digital Death Day? It sounds awfully morbid. Wouldn't you normally have it at the end of October?
That would be good timing, but I think it's a topic that's always appropriate. Digital Death Day is an event that started in 2010 by one of the sort of top researchers on the topic of digital death, Stacey Pitsilides. And basically, it's an open workshop that's going to be taking place October 6th from 10 o'clock to 6, or to 5, sorry. And what it's going to do is sort of discuss the topics around digital death. What happens to, what is our legacy? What is all the information that we have through social media, through, photo sites? What is this information? How is it being used out there? What are the permissions around it? How do we archive it? And really, what does it mean after we die?
So it's more about our physical deaths as opposed to the death of, say, a social network or the death of an online game or the death of something digital. It's more about us offline.
Well, no, actually, it's about us online. It's our personas online. It's sort of all the tentacles that we've created in our online world, whether It's from the practical, which goes into, you know, just have you made your will and you can now do that online? Have you organized passwords, and there's sites now that allow you to pass on your passwords to next of kin? What happens to your email permissions? So it's that practical side, but then it's also, you know, what about all your photographs? What about all your tweets? What does that mean? To you as a person and to the people that you're leaving that information behind for, what does that mean in terms of your legacy?
That is actually quite interesting, given that we are not just the sum of, you know, of our physical objects. When we die, you know, you hear about things like estate sales and right. bank accounts, et cetera. But now we're starting to share online assets. So photographs that I've taken that in the past would have been, you know, in a physical box under the bed are now, say, on Flickr or on Instagram or in various sure. other online things. So the identity, the parts of the identity of the people who were in those photographs are also sort of, they're in the digital ether and they don't necessarily have access to those. So these are some of the things we need to think about. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to also, you have to consider, you know, who you're hosting that information with and, you know, what are the permissions and sort of the privacy policies of, you know, Flickr is owned by Yahoo and Yahoo has a no transferable policy. So it's also, you know, once your account that you've taken that photo and you've placed it on your account, but now, who owns that? Do you, you know, after you've gone, who actually owns that photograph?
I think it's a really, really interesting point. And I'm not sure that a lot of the general public realize that all, you know, what you're talking about, Alex and Adriana, the makeup of one's digital estate, which years gone by would have been physical photographs in car boxes in your garage or boxes of vinyl, videos, all these things that are now sort of virtually stored in the cloud or, you know, on, you know, in iTunes. A lot of these different aspects of your estate aren't owned by you or certainly are not transferable by you. And we're talking about, you know, real sums of money. A lot of people invest a lot of money in iTunes or, as you're talking about there, Adriana, Flickr. I mean, those photographs, you know, once you pass on, you're not meant to transfer your password to somebody else. And if you do, then your account is void. And I just don't think the general public realizes this.
It was interesting, actually, the other week, wasn't it, that that Bruce Willis hit the headlines because he said that he wanted to leave the content of his apparently extensive iTunes library to his children, as opposed to Apple. So how do you negotiate that? How Adriana, do you recommend that people negotiate their digital assets? And actually, Victoria, we'll talk a little bit more about that with you, I'm sure.
Mm. Well, it is tricky. I know from personal experience that in a case of having to previously take over a Yahoo mail account for my mother, I actually had to be in possession of her password, and she had to verbally hand that to me, or there was going to be absolutely no way that I could get into her email. Now, she told me it was okay for me to do that, and I think it's about, you know, sort of setting your wishes for your digital life to the people. But how do you organize that? I mean, I think you do really have to see, check privacy policies before you sign up for services and make sure that you agree with those policies, you know, should something like this occur.
Now, Victoria, it's interesting, isn't it, that this kind of forces us to think about what is it that's actually important to us online? Because there's a whole bunch of stuff that I've got online that I'm like, ah, yeah, whatever. You know, it's kind of the equivalent of junk mail. It's kind of the equivalent of stuff that I've done, I've put to the side, whatever. But it actually may be something important to somebody. Or, you know, how do we identify? How does a person like myself, who's, you know, making a will, identify what is actually important to me in the digital world?
Well, it's interesting you ask, and I know, Alex, that you write blogs and so on, and one of the examples that's frequently touted around when people are discussing digital estate, I know it sounds quite cliched, but if Shakespeare had blogged his plays, you know, there's a big question about whether he would have owned them or not. And I think each of us has our own different area of interest or things that are important to us. And it's those parts of your digital estate that are important. A lot of parents take photographs now of children, and again, they would assume that they own those, when actually, in a lot of cases, they don't. And there are companies out there that will help you assess and monitor your digital estate, and in the event that something happens to you, deal with that on your behalf. And our Legacy Organizer app, whilst it won't manage your digital estate, it does prompt you to think about all these issues. You know, where are your passwords? I mean, my husband wouldn't have a clue about any of our online banking. He wouldn't know, you know, what accounts we have, where they are. Similarly, I'm not into the world of gaming, but a lot of games have, you know, there's real money, real revenue involved. And if you are a serious gamer or you do a lot on these virtual life sites, there's real hard cash being transacted. And if you die and, you know, your account is closed, where is that money? What's happening to it? Who knows about it? I mean, there are some kind of massive, you know, proper financial issues here.
Who's thinking about this, Adriana? Obviously, there will be lawyers who are thinking about this, I'm hoping.
This is sort of a topic that's becoming, you know, is sort of the e-will. And, you know, can you actually authenticate a signature online? You know, what about hacking issues? I mean, you know, you start, you know, putting all your assets and all of this important information online. How safe is it? Who is it with? How long does it last? I mean, you know, it was a transition when we first started banking online. People didn't feel comfortable about that, but now we couldn't imagine a world without online banking. But I do think people, this is sort of the next step. It's, but I would suggest that in sort of any online will, e-will that you leave, you print it out, make it a hard copy, because how do you find the balance between the physical world and the online world? And that goes, you know, in terms of digital death, I mean, I think it's a really important balance to strike. And even in terms of your persona, you know, there's the whole practical aspect. But then what do you as a person want people to, you know, how do they want you to remember? And like you said, there's a lot of just fuzz. There's a lot of chatter and too much information. And how do we sort of organize that one and streamline it? One thing I know that taking, you know, sort of the idea of our digital death and our sort of online digital lives and what that means after we're not here is that it has made us sort of think about our mortality, I think, a lot more closely, because these things are coming into our face all the time. You know, you go into Facebook, you find out a friend has passed away. You wouldn't have necessarily been confronted in that way. It makes you then come back and think about your own mortality and think about how people are talking about them and how that would translate to you. I think there is a personal responsibility to.
Yeah, I mean, Victoria, that is an interesting question. It's not just about the pragmatics, but it's also about, you know, some of the rituals that surround death as well. You know, it's about the identity and the crafting of the persona online. It's a very reflexive process, isn't it?
It is. And I think what's very interesting is, you know, when social media first came along, we were all caught up in the buzz and social networkings of the here and the now and exchanging information and where we are and sharing. And there's definitely been, I think, a stand back from that. And you look at Facebook's timeline to something of more reflection, of looking back, of assessing. And in terms of our Legacy Organizer app, the app has been designed for people to take stock and to reflect on their lives. And it's very interesting, Adriana, talking about one's mortality, because I came up with the idea for the app when I had my own will drawn up. And although I was able to go through a legal process of documenting what I wanted, you know, guardians for my children and my physical estate, I realized there was nowhere to store information about how I would like to be remembered and my life to be celebrated. So I suddenly found myself sending all these emails, bombarding my younger brother with emails about what songs I would like played at my funeral, you know, what things I would like mentioned in a eulogy, you know, and telling my younger brother to throw some money at it and give me a good send-off. So I think this idea of our kind of mortality, we all have something in our lives which kind of triggers us to really think about that, whether it is the death of a friend or a family member or a new baby coming into the world, or even, you know, you read a very good book. I remember reading One Day by David Nichols, and it just really spoke to me, and I really thought about my own mortality. And I think this idea of reflection is one that everyone is really, you know, it's almost a kind of wave of reflection.
I do agree that, you know, absolutely technology has almost empowered us to sort of become more in control of what happens to our legacy. But, you know, as a question to you, do you guide people in your app to, because the one question about sort of writing down this information is how often do you then update it? And do you constantly engage with your mortality or... Because it's moving so quickly, so a song or something that might seem right in 2012, do you go back in 2014 and make sure that everything still feels correct? And that's sort of a new area that we're going into as we sort of put our affairs in order. How long does that last for us personally and then also sort of online?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I'll be exploring it this weekend, actually. I'm coming along to the Digital Death Day, and I'm going to have a look at the app as well. Victoria, thank you both very much for joining us, and I'm already sort of curating the Flickr slideshow that's going to happen at my own memorial service. George Orwell's 1984, A Word a Day. Anyway, thank you both very much, and that's the Legacy app, and it's Digital Death Day this weekend. That was Adriana Kazimatis from Digital Death Day and Victoria Moore, creator of the Legacy app for iPhone. That's it for this week. Next week, we're speaking with the head of digital for London 2012 about how he and his amazing team have transformed what we expect from live event coverage and what he feels is the true digital legacy of the Olympic Games. Thanks to Charles Arthur and to Tech Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratofsky. See you next week.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's kobo.com, and at checkout put in the discount code Mafia State for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.